We're in Ecclesiastes chapter 5, and we're studying wealth. In this section of Ecclesiastes chapter 5, running all the way from verse 10 down through chapter 6, verse 9, the theme is wealth, and we're learning here that earthly wealth is frustrating, but God gives us a blessing. And this is arranged chiastically so that on the outside we see twice the frustrations of earthly wealth, how futile it is to try to be satisfied with material things for two main reasons. The first is that it doesn't bring satisfaction, and the second thing is that you tend to lose it. When you've got it, it doesn't make you happy, and you can't keep it indefinitely. It has a way of going away. So earthly wealth cannot bring satisfaction. Now last time, we looked at chapter 5, verse 10, down through chapter 5, verse 17. And this was the point that we saw there, the frustration associated with earthly wealth. It just cannot bring satisfaction, and it tends to run away. The bottom line there was verse 17. The man who seeks earthly wealth all his days also, he eateth in darkness, and he hath much sorrow and wrath with his sickness. That is man's lot. Whatever he enjoys, he's able to enjoy only in darkness. It's like a prisoner. I read once that when people are locked up in solitary confinement, when they feed them, they have to feed them nourishing food because, at least in our culture, it's considered a responsibility that we have toward prisoners. Wasn't that way in the old world, but it is in our day. But when people are locked up in solitary confinement, what they do is they put all the food in a blender and stir it up into a just sort of a creamy paste, and then they serve it sort of cool in a paper cup. But, you know, so what if you're getting steak and potatoes and salad and ice cream, if it's all sort of blended up into one mush and served in a soggy paper cup? It's not very much fun. And that's about as much satisfaction as man gets out of his wealth. He eateth in darkness. He hath much sorrow and wrath with his sickness. Now we've seen that Mr. Preacher has a very realistic view of what life is like, and he doesn't hesitate to point out the frustrations and dissatisfactions of life on this earth. But that doesn't mean he's a pessimist, because Mr. Preacher is a believer. And as a believer, he knows that God has a blessing for his people. Chapter 5, verse 18. Behold that which I have seen. It is good and comely for one to eat and to drink and to enjoy the good of all his labor that he taketh under the sun all the days of his life which God giveth him, for it is his portion. Every man also to whom God hath given riches and wealth, and hath given him power to eat thereof, and to take his portion, and to rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. For he shall not much remember the days of his life, because God answereth him in the joy of his heart. Verses 18 and 19 really tell us the same thing in two different sets of words. They both tell us the object of life. They tell us the context in which we're able to enjoy that object. They tell us who it is that gives this gift to us, and they tell us who can hope to enjoy the gift. The gift that we have in both cases is enjoying good. Verse 18, it is good and comely for one to eat and to drink and to enjoy good. And in verse 19, we read of a man who has the ability to eat thereof, that is, to enjoy the riches and wealth that he has received, and to take his portion and to rejoice in his labor. What is there in life that we can look forward to? Well, we can just enjoy ourselves. That's the bottom line here. What's life for? It's for enjoying yourself. Just have a good time. Enjoy good. Eat and drink. Take the portion that you have. In the course of your labor, we've made a big distinction in the book, and we see it repeated here, between expecting something from our labor and enjoying good in our labor. If you expect something from your labor, you will be disappointed. If you say to yourself, I'm going to work and work and work real hard, and finally, someday, as a result of everything that I've done, I'm going to be comfortable and happy. That's frustrating. The reason it's frustrating is you can't be sure. You can work and work and work real hard, and maybe you'll be a success. And maybe you won't. You don't control that. God does. So if all of your life is devoted to sacrificing and to depriving yourself in the hopes that from your labor you will one day be satisfied, you're a fool. Or you might succeed. You might win. You might lose. People lose more often than you might expect. This is directly counter to the American theme, which is hard work always pays off if you're diligent and you work real hard. Someday you too can be a Lee Iacocca or a Cornelius Vanderbilt. Someday you too can be hugely successful. Yeah, but you might end up being a John DeLorean. Probably the brightest rising star of the American automotive industry. And what happens to him? Impoverished through the legal battles that he got himself into. You can work real hard, and maybe you'll succeed, and maybe you won't. So don't expect good from your labor. Now, you still have to labor. God has placed us here to labor. So we're not saying don't labor. That's our responsibility. That's the lot that God has given us, to work. But his instruction to us is enjoy good in your labor. That's clearly stated in verse 19. At the end of the verse, we are to rejoice in our labor. It's also stated in verse 18, although the translation that we have obscures it a little bit. It is good and comely for one to eat and to drink and to enjoy good in all his labor. That's what the Hebrew text says. Not to enjoy the good of all his labor, which almost sounds like a from. We're never told to do this in Ecclesiastes. We are to enjoy good in our labor, in the course of the labor that we do. We labor because God has given us labor. We are diligent because God commands us to be diligent. And after all, think of your motives for hard work. If your motives for hard work are to please yourself, you're just an idolater. You're not serving God, you're serving yourself. The godly motive for hard work is that God commands us to do it. And we do it out of obedience to Him. That's a godly motive for hard work. If you work hard simply to be rich, if that's your motive, you're pursuing the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, and that's not godly. But in the midst of the labor that we perform, because that is our portion, because that's our lot upon this world, in that labor, enjoy good. Yes, that's God's blessing to us. And it is God's blessing. We do not control it ourselves. Mr. Preacher mentions this twice. In verse 18, he tells us that this is what God giveth him. Enjoy the good of all his labor that he taketh under the sun all the days of his life, which God giveth him. Every moment that we have to see the sun, to breathe the air, to enjoy God's blessings, that's a day that God has given to us. We can't count on it. We shouldn't assume that it's going to be there. Verse 19. This is every man that God gives riches, God gives, to whom God hath given riches and wealth, and hath given him power to eat thereof. I remember talking once to a visiting scholar from, I believe, Saudi Arabia, one of the Middle Eastern countries, at a departmental picnic when I was at the university. He commented that when one is young, one has strength and one's sensitivities are well-tuned and one is able to enjoy all the wonderful things in life, but one can't afford them. And then as one gets older and you're able to work and you save up a little bit of money, now you can afford all the wonderful things in life, but now your body starts to run down. As one of my employees said, I just turned 30 and my warranty expired. And now you can't enjoy them anymore. You can buy the fancy food, but your taste buds aren't quite as sharp as they used to be and you can't appreciate them. You can now afford to take the lovely trips, but now your eyes don't work so well and you can't see the scenery as well. It's God who gives us the power to enjoy the things that He gives to us. This, says Mr. Preacher, is the gift of God. It's God who enables us to enjoy good in our labor. The fourth thing to note here is that there is a distinction between the two verses. Verse 18 speaks of Mr. Preacher's own experience. Behold that which I have seen. While verse 19 extends it to every man. So here we have a general principle. The blessing of God is the ability to enjoy good in the course of our daily labor. And that's true not only for Mr. Preacher, it's true for every man. And it's true for us. Verse 20, he shall not much remember the days of his life, because God answereth him in the joy of his heart. The days of our life, as this book shows us over and over again, are pretty cruddy. If you think that life is a bed of roses, then you and Mr. Preacher are on two different wavelengths. And the Holy Spirit, by including this book within the canon of Scripture, wants us to recognize that life is really lousy. And that's called the fall, folks. That's what happened as a result of the sin of our first parents in Eden. The world is not a nice place to live. 20th century middle class America with a Kmart on every corner and a bank balance and cost of living increases in salaries and so forth, that's a lie. Our whole society, our whole Western culture of making a wonderful life for ourselves is really a lie. It's trying to hide the fact of the fall. If we lived in a country where not enough rain in the spring meant we starved in the fall, that'd be a whole lot more accurate representation of what the world is really like. Now, we've managed to hide from ourselves just what a terrible place man's sin has made the world, but Mr. Preacher's not going to let us forget it. Life is not fun. It's sad. It's difficult. Even in this country, people know that. And how do they try to forget life? Well, they go get drunk. Or they get high on drugs. Do you think alcohol and drugs would be necessary if life were nice? No, it wouldn't be. These things that take away our sensitivities, that cause us to forget, they are ways that people use to try to get around the fallenness of our creation. The Christian has another answer. We don't have to remember the days of our life either. God gives us joy in our hearts. We don't have to take drugs or drink alcohol to be able to overcome the sadness of daily life. God gives us joy in our hearts. There are three responses that one can take to the state of the world. Two of them are wrong, and one of them is here. Wrong response number one is to say, oh, the world, that's great. I'm going to enjoy it the way it is. Then we miss the point of the fall. Response number two is to say, life is lousy, I'm going to go get stoned, and then I won't have to pay attention to it. And that's wrong, too. The third response is to say, life is lousy, but God gives me joy in the course of my labor, and I will enjoy that present that He gives to me. And that will enable me not to remember the frustrations and the sadness of my daily life. And that is Mr. Preacher's solution. So he's telling us here that God gives us blessing, not from our labor, but in our labor. And now he turns back to the first theme, that earthly wealth is frustrating. It cannot bring satisfaction. It's very short-lived. It goes away quickly. It's easy to lose. Chapter 6, verse 1. There is an evil which I have seen under the sun, and it is common among men. A man to whom God hath given riches, wealth, and honor, so that he wanteth nothing for his soul of all that he desireth. Yet God giveth him not power to eat thereof, but a stranger eateth it. This is vanity, and it is an evil disease. If a man beget 100 children and live many years, so that the days of his years be many, and his soul be not filled with good, and also that he have no burial, I say that an untimely birth is better than he. For he cometh in with vanity, and departeth in darkness, and his name shall be covered with darkness. Moreover, he hath not seen the sun, nor known anything. This hath more rest than the other. Confused? It's okay, I'll try to explain it in a minute. Yea, though he live 1,000 years twice told, yet hath he seen no good. Do not all go to one place? All the labor of man is for his mouth, and yet the appetite is not filled. For what hath the wise more than the fool? What hath the poor that knoweth to walk before the living? Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the desire. This is also vanity and vexation of spirit. And looking now at the futility of wealth, we turn to two case histories, one in verse 2 and one in verses 3 through 6. Examples of how wealth does not bring satisfaction. The first example is just verse 2. Here is a man who has everything that he could want. Riches, wealth, honor, so that he wanteth nothing for his soul of all that he desireth. He has everything his heart longs for. Yet, God giveth him not power to eat thereof. Remember, back in verse 19? It's a gift from God to have the ability to enjoy the things of this world. Here is a man that has everything that he could long for, yet God does not give him power to eat of it. We don't know why. Perhaps he has a disease of some sort. Maybe his teeth fell out and he can't chew good food. Maybe he dies young, so that he's got all of his money saved up, like the man in the Gospels, the parable that the Lord told of the rich man who had tremendous harvests and said, I'm going to build big barns now and store up all this wealth that I've finally gotten. Now I can relax. I'll store it up. I'll live off it. And God said to him, thou fool, this night shall thy soul be required of thee. And whose shall then be those things? That's what happens to this fellow. He has it all. He has the riches, but they can't bring him satisfaction. He does not have power to enjoy them. A stranger eateth it. This is vanity. And it is an evil disease. Another case. If a man beget 100 children, I think we can safely assume that more than one wife is involved in this activity, and live many years so that the days of his years be many, and his soul be not filled with good, and also that he have no burial. I think we're looking here at some kind of a great ruler. He's got a huge harem. Many, many children. And yet when he gets to the end of his life, he does not have a burial. That sometimes happens to rulers, you know. And they get overthrown. And then they're dishonored by the next regime. As long as your son comes to power, then he'll give you a nice burial. But if you are assassinated and somebody else takes your throne, then they throw you out on the ash heap outside the gate. A couple of examples of that in the Bible you'll find where rulers are treated exactly that way. So here is a man who establishes a great kingdom, lives many years, but at the end somebody comes along and overthrows him in a coup. What good is it? He can't enjoy all the things that he has attained. He's compared at the end of the verse to a stillborn child. Mr. Preacher says that this kind of a life, amassing together wealth only to be overthrown, only to have it taken from you. You see, the first fellow we saw didn't have the power to eat of it. This fellow has it taken away, deprived of it by an overthrow. Mr. Preacher says it would be better to be a stillborn child than to be a man like this. He cometh in with vanity, emptiness. Well, we all come that way. Naked we come into the world. And he departeth in darkness, and his name shall be covered with darkness. This again points to somebody who suffered political reversal. He is dishonored. His name now is shamed. He was prominent, but now he is put down. Moreover, he hath not seen the sun nor known anything. Now, verse 5 points us to the child. Here is the child. He knows neither satisfaction nor frustration. He doesn't know what it means to have a lot of wealth, nor does he know what it means to lose it. The ruler goes up and down. The child never knows anything. And then Mr. Preacher says, which one has more rest? Which one has more contentment and more satisfaction of life? Is it better to be queen for a day and then end up a slave? Or is it better just to know nothing, see nothing. You think about the vicissitudes of royal life in the ancient world. I think maybe we can appreciate what Mr. Preacher is saying when he says, you know, it's better to be a stillborn child than to be an assassinated king. That sounds like a very harsh assessment. What he's telling us is that all this striving after success, where the gamble is so great, the stress is so high, our nerves are so tight, and we're up one day and we're down the next, better never to have lived at all than to go through that kind of a roller coaster. This hath more rest than the other. Yea, though he live 1,000 years twice told. What if someone could live 2,000 years? Or, as the rabbis interpret the verse, 1,000 times 1,000. What if a person could live 1,000,000 years? Yet if he doesn't see any good, if he does not have the power that God gives to enjoy good from his life, do not all go to one place? Doesn't everybody die finally? In the face of that coming death, the assurance that death is coming someday, what satisfaction is there? What good is it to live 1,000,000 years if you can't enjoy good and all you have to look forward to is death? There's no satisfaction. The frustration of earthly wealth, of basing our satisfaction on success and prosperity in this life, it's futile. It's empty. Verses 7 and 8 ask a question and give two answers that provide the conclusion to this section. The question is in verse 8, beginning of the verse. What hath the wise more than the fool? You'll remember way back in the early chapters of the book, Mr. Preacher studied wisdom and folly. He didn't find folly satisfying, but he also didn't find wisdom satisfying in itself. And now he's returning to this question. What has the wise more than the fool? What advantage does the wise man have? Now, we're actually going to see an advantage to wisdom in the next chapter, so hang on there. But look at the two answers that he gives to this question. One in the form of a statement in verse 7, and the other in the form of a question at the end of verse 8. So the question that he asks is in the middle, and the two answers are one on either side. Verse 7, all the labor of man is for his mouth, and yet the appetite is not filled. Both the wise man and the fool have unsatisfied appetites. Neither one can really be satisfied from the things of this life. They work to satisfy their mouths, and yet they're not satisfied. The end of verse 8, here's your answer. What hath the poor that knoweth to walk before the living? The advantage that the wise man has over the fool is whatever advantage a poor wise man has over a poor fool. To understand what's going on here, we have to recognize that there is an equation or a process that's pretty much taken for granted in our culture and also in the Old Testament. Or should I say, among people of a Jewish background, we're seeing here the Old Testament does not endorse this idea. But the basic idea is that if you are wise, that will bring wealth, and if you are wealthy, that will bring happiness. If you are wise, that will bring wealth, and if you are wealthy, that will bring happiness. Now, isn't that pretty much the backbone of our educational system even today in our society? You know, you go to college so that you can gain wisdom, and that's going to let you make a lot of money. And why do you want to make a lot of money? Well, so you can be happy. Okay, so there it is in a nutshell. And now he's challenging that. 8a, what has the wise more than the fool? Not satisfaction. All the labor of man is for his mouth, and yet the appetite is not filled. The more you've got, the more you want. The more you want, the harder you work to get some more, and the more you've got, the more you want. There's no satisfaction. And 8b, he says, look, you look at a poor wise man. A poor man who knows how to walk before the living. Whatever advantage he has, that's the advantage of wisdom. Not that it's going to make you wise, because there are lots of poor wise people around. I should say, not that it's going to make you wealthy. There are lots of poor, wise people around. You look at a poor, wise man, whatever advantage he has over a fool is the advantage that you can expect from wisdom. He is directly challenging this equation, that wisdom brings wealth and wealth brings happiness. Those things aren't linked together that way. He's decoupling wisdom from prosperity. Each one of these is a separate gift from God. Wisdom, we know we should strive after. We're commanded to be wise. You read the book of Proverbs. Wisdom is exalted and folly is a terrible thing. So this is something that we should all definitely seek. We cannot be guaranteed wealth. If God gives it, it's a gift. If he doesn't give it, so he doesn't give it. It's not a right. We don't have a right to be wealthy. Happiness? God gives happiness. That's a gift of God, but it's really independent of wealth. There are rich men who are very sad, and there are poor people who are very, very happy. So these three things are decoupled in Mr. Preacher's view of the world. He says wisdom does not necessarily bring wealth, and wealth does not necessarily bring happiness. Yes, you can be wise, and you should be. Yes, you may be wealthy if that is God's pleasure. Yes, you can be happy. God gives happiness to his people. But recognize that all three come from God. You can't guarantee yourself any of these by working your way through the front door and going to the back door. You've got to receive each one as it comes from God and trust him for it. Verse 9 sort of closes off this whole section on wealth. Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the desire. This is also vanity and vexation of spirit. One final closing remark. Don't be led astray by desire, because it'll never be satisfied. Enjoy the things you have rather than longing for the things you don't have, because the things you don't have, you may never have. Now, with this, we have reached the midpoint of the book. I'm sure that all of you, being vitally interested in Ecclesiastes, have counted the verses in the book, and you can all tell me how many there are. Well, maybe you can't. Actually, I never count the verses in books, but I happened to read how many there were in this book. There are 222 verses in Ecclesiastes. Half of 222 is 111, and chapter 6, verse 9, is number 111. So this brings us exactly to the middle of the book. And in fact, as you read through the book, things get... Well, they seem to be a little bit confused from this point on. At least in my preliminary readings through the book, things seem to make sense until I get to this point, and then they start to fall apart until I get down to chapter 11. So there'll be a good deal of exploration as we press on past the midpoint of the book. But we're actually at the middle. We've gotten there a good deal more rapidly than I thought we would. And we proceed now to a section that emphasizes God's sovereignty over us in our daily lives. It tells us how dependent we are on God. We see God's sovereignty in verses 10 through 12 of chapter 6. And then, in chapter 7, we learn in the light of that sovereignty the value of sorrow and unhappiness. We can't get away from it, and Mr. Preacher will not let us put blinders on our eyes and say life is lovely. He's not going to let us do that, but he is going to tell us why there is sorrow in the world and how to respond to it. So we begin then at chapter 6 and verse 10 to contemplate God's sovereignty. And this little paragraph raises some questions that we cannot answer by ourselves. Verse 10 shows us the scope of God's sovereignty. That which hath been is named already, and it is known what man shall be. That's probably a little bit smoother translation than what we have here. It is known that it is man. Neither may he contend with him that is mightier than he. Seeing there be many things that increase vanity, what is man the better? For who knoweth what is good for man in this life, all the days of his vain life which he spendeth as a shadow? For who can tell a man what shall be after him under the sun? Verse 10 has two parts to the first half of it. That which hath been is named already, and it is known what man shall be. Let's think a little bit about naming. It's not an accidental thing in the Bible. How do we name children? We're just going to pick names out of books. What kind of name do you pick? You pick from a book. What kind of name do you pick for a child from a book? Do you ever hear anybody name their child Disaster? Dizzy for short. How about Flunky? Anyone ever call a child Flunky? What kinds of names do people give their children? Names that suggest happiness and success or strength or prestige. People's names for their children express the hopes that they have for what their children will become. This reflects a very deep-seated feeling in the Bible that to name something is to have control over it. The very first instance of naming in the Bible is when God creates the animals and brings them to man so that man can name them. You've got two stories of creation. Chapter 1, God creates man and gives him dominion over the beasts of the earth, the fowl of the air, the fish of the sea. In chapter 2, he creates man and brings them all to man to name. Same thing. To name something is to have dominion over it. What happens with the patriarchs when God begins to work in their lives? He renames them. When they enter into a personal relationship with God so that they are now under his control, he changes their name, asserting his authority over them. You'll even see it in the last kings of Israel under the Babylonian and Assyrian kings, how their foreign overlords would rename the kings to demonstrate that they have authority over them. So when you give something a name, you are determining its destiny. You're determining its character. The name of God is his character. When Moses asked God to show Moses God's glory, God responded by reciting his name. That was the revelation of his character, who he was. So Mr. Preacher says, that which hath been, everything that is named already. Its character has been established. Its destiny has been fixed. It is controlled. The world is not run at random. It is not running open loop. It is all named. It is all controlled. And here I think he's concentrating on the impersonal aspects of our world. Events of history, natural history, the forces that are all around us. Everything is named. It is controlled. And it is known what man shall be. Man's destiny is also determined. Many people around us are, sort of comfortable with the idea that the world basically follows laws, but they steadfastly resist the notion that man himself is determined. But Mr. Preacher says, no, man is known too. It is known what man shall be. God's sovereignty includes the impersonal world and us as personal individuals. He has determined us. He has named us. He controls us. As a result, we are impotent in two directions. We are impotent vertically and we are impotent horizontally. We cannot oppose God vertically, and we cannot really understand our own situation horizontally. We are determined by God. Vertically, 10b. Neither may he, that is man, contend with him that is mightier than he. What's contend mean? It means to fight. Or argue. Here especially it means to argue. It means to enter into judgment with somebody. To take someone to court. You can't take God to court. You can sue the federal government, but you can't sue God. The federal government stands under the Constitution, and you can say, look, it's going contrary to the Constitution, it's going contrary to its own laws, I can sue it. You can never sue God. He's not subject to anyone or anything. And that's what verse 10 is talking about. Seeing there be many things that increase vanity. The word things here really is the Hebrew word for words. Seeing there be many words that increase vanity. These are the words of people who try to argue with God, who try to contend with God. And it's just vain. It's empty. It brings man no benefit. That's vertical impotence, vertical weakness. Man cannot contend with God or change God's mind about anything. Now, on the horizontal scale, verse 12, man is ignorant about his own state, and he really can't learn anything about it. Who knoweth what is good for man in this life, all the days of his vain life which he spendeth as a shadow? For who can tell a man what shall be after him under the sun? I have two statements here that are very similar to one another. Both of them point out man's ignorance in the form of a question. Who knoweth? Who can tell? Both of them point out something that would be an advantage. Who knoweth what is good for man? Who can tell a man what shall be after him? Man can't figure out what's really good for him. He can't know what will follow him in this life. And the parallelism suggests that we should reflect on the coupling between these two. What is good for a man and what follows after him are very close together in most people's minds. For a lot of folk, success consists in leaving something behind when we die. Consists in making a name for ourselves and either leaving an inheritance to our children or leaving an institution that we have founded, or at least having people think, boy, that was a nice person, when we're gone, leaving our memorials. Who knows what is good for a man? Who can tell a man what shall be after him? We can't tell what people will think of us, what history will say about us. We can't establish any good in this sense. And now look at the context in each case. Who knows what is good for man in this life, all the days of his vain life which he spendeth as a shadow? We are like a shadow. We come and we're gone. Our life is transitory. It's fixed. It's limited by death. Who knows what is good for man in this short little life that he lives? We're forced here to think about the temporal limitations of our life, and that puts us face to face with eternity. The frustrations with the time bounds on our life force us to think beyond. What is there beyond? What is there that comes after? It's inaccessible to us, but there must be something more. And similarly, from a geographical sense, the second part of the verse is limited to life under the sun. Who can tell a man what shall be after him under the sun? And that faces us up with the fact of heaven, the anticipation that there is something beyond, something outside of our grasp. Well, the implied answer to the question of verse 12 is that nobody can tell us what is good. Thus, we're a little bit surprised when we get to chapter 7 and all of a sudden we start learning about things that are good. The word good appears 52 times in the book of Ecclesiastes. Let's do some arithmetic, shall we?
Ugh.
My weekend's the only time I don't have to do arithmetic, and now they do arithmetic, even in the sermon. 52 times the word good occurs, and how many chapters are there in Ecclesiastes? There are 12 chapters. Good. Now let's see. How many times does 12 go into 52? Well, you know, Drew?
Four times.
With a little bit left over. 4 1/3, right? Good. So, if we were just reading Ecclesiastes through, about how many times should we find the word good in each chapter? About 4 or 5 times. 4 times in some chapters, 5 times in other chapters. Well, not unless it's sort of split over the end of a chapter. Because as a matter of fact, you see, the Hebrew word for good has 3 letters in it. A T, a W, and a B. So it would be very easy to split it right there, but most chapters don't split that way. This chapter has 14 occurrences of the word good in it. That's a third of all the occurrences of the word good appear in chapter 7. I think he's answering the question of chapter 6. Who knows what is good for a man? Nobody down here knows, but God knows. God knows what is good, and God's going to tell us what is good. Right here in chapter 7. And it centers around the notion of suffering. The notion of sorrow. We've seen that it's part and parcel of our lives. Now he's going to tell us that there actually is good that comes from it. Listen to the verses. A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death is better than the day of one's birth. It's better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. Verse 3, sorrow is better than laughter. Verse 4, the heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. Verse 5, it's better to hear the rebuke of the wise than for a man to hear the song of fools. This doesn't sound like the great society, does it? Does it sound puzzling to you? Why should sadness be better than happiness? Why should rebuke be better than laughter and songs? Well, we don't have time to look at that this morning. But that's what we'll consider next week, Lord willing, when we come back to this passage. God knows what is good for man in this life. It's probably not the kind of things that we think of as good. But we need to get God's perspective on life, and that means getting God's perspective on suffering. We will learn here why we should bear suffering and sorrow, and also how we should bear it. All that in chapter 7, verses 1 through 14, when we gather next to study Ecclesiastes. Until then, leave you to puzzle over that and suggest that we sing in closing a hymn about God's sovereign rule over our lives, how vast the benefits divine which we in Christ possess. There in the second section of the blue binder. How vast the benefits divine which we in Christ possess. We can't do anything to help ourselves, spiritually or materially, but God has given us salvation through the Lord Jesus Christ.